This week on Writers, Inc.
I find it more entertaining to write these interconnected, the more mosaic type stories. And in this, each book in this series to date is intended that you can pick it up without having read the previous ones.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
They call me Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So we're going to put Jenna on the spot. I heard you're reviewing for somebody new.
I am. You are looking at the newest official reviewer for Publishers Weekly.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Congratulations. Yay. That's cool.
Yeah. It's my first one where I don't get to pick the book. So it's going to be a fun adventure.
Yeah, that's the only part I don't like about your announcement.
I don't know. I am a very adventurous reader, actually. So I really don't mind it. I sort of pick the books I review now sort of randomly. Like I'll just like get a stack and send them to like an editor, and then they'll be like, I want that one. And I'm like, great. So, I mean, it's always sort of been like not up to me.
Yeah. Now, are you a fast reader? Do you read very, very quickly?
Compared to some people I know, no. Compared to other people, yes. So I don't know. I can read. I read a couple books a week, probably.
Okay.
So I'm officially in the mystery thriller genre at Publishers Weekly. They have it set up with different genres. So thrillers I tend to read pretty fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, that's why I'm upset, because I want you to be able to choose my books.
Well. Even if they assigned me your books, I don't know. I'd have to tell them I know you and I work with you.
Yeah.
You can't like just not say that. And I don't know. It's exciting. It's fun.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So can you be bribed? Like, where do I send the check?
Let's talk after the podcast.
Gotcha. Okay.
See, there's nothing that says she can't actually review the book. It just won't go into Publishers Weekly.
Oh, man. All right. What is going on in the news?
Well, before we jump into the news, we got a listener question. To the wonderful listener out there who asked this question, how do you get readers to buy your standalone books over a series?
Yeah, so I'm guessing we were talking about this, like, I guess a week or two ago, right? So from my standpoint, what I've always done, or what I did, is I went back and forth, which is something I copied from Stephen King. So I wrote Fourth Monkey, which was the first in the series. Then the next book was a standalone. Then I wrote the second book in the series. Then I put out another standalone, and then the third book in the series. So I went back and forth like that, which is what I saw him doing with the Mr. Mercedes series.
Yeah.
My general thinking, and it seems to have worked, is that by jumping back and forth, the readers, basically they'll grab onto both formats. They'll do series and they'll do standalones. Because I have noticed that, like, from a read-through standpoint, if somebody picks up The Fourth Monkey, it's their first book from me, they'll read that entire series, and then, sometimes they move on to another title of mine, sometimes they don't. But, by mixing it up like that, I think I definitely grabbed a lot of people at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say, this isn't usually an issue for me, because this is exactly why I've spent my entire career cultivating myself as the brand rather than any particular series or whatever. And I am known for one series in particular, but I periodically release things completely outside of that, and my readers all gravitate toward it. Finding new readers, that would be much more challenging. If you're known for something and you're trying to attract new readers into the fold, a standalone book probably isn't going to be real easy to promote.
I don't know. I think a lot of people pick up standalone just to test out an author, because you don't want to try a new author with a series, right? Because now you're committed to three books or five books or nine books.
Yeah.
I was going to say, as a reader, I definitely I like standalones from authors, especially if they already have sort of like a longer running series. It's kind of nice to just get like a little taste, and
A
not have to
complete
worry
meal.
about. Well, yeah, because I mean, I love series, but if you come to find the series early, then you're waiting like a year between books at minimum. Sometimes you wait a decade, George R. R. Martin. Sorry about that. I got something stuck in my throat, but I don't know. It can be nice.
All right. Now, the
Now
news.
we'll get to the news. So Amazon's killing a feature that let you download and backup Kindle books. Amazon is retiring a feature that allows Kindle users to download purchased books to their computers. While the feature is mainly for users who can't transfer straight to their device via Wi-Fi, it's also another way to hold onto your purchased copy in case Amazon removes or modifies the title, which has happened. The article states, "It's a reminder that you don't actually own much of the digital content you consume, and without the ability to back up copies of ebooks, you could lose them entirely if they're banned and removed. The download option will be gone starting February 26th, but you can find instructions for how to access the feature between now and then in the article."
Now, I didn't even know you could do this, but this sounds like a pirate's dream, right? Because, as an author, when you post a book, you can tell them whether you want to turn DRM on or off. I think it's off by default, so that means most of our books are floating around out there in a downloadable format and apparently sitting on a lot of hard drives.
I have mixed feelings about this. I mean, like, I can't imagine, as I've probably made clear, getting rid of my Kindle. So it's a weird idea. I mean, for me, if I really love a book, I will usually have both the digital copy and a hard copy. I mean, if I love it. So I don't know. Like, as a reader, I understand the outrage, but as an author too, like, if you had a book, like, it doesn't happen very often, but Stephen King has that book, what was it, Rage, that he unpublished essentially, and he did not want to make it available just because of how it was being taken and sort of being attributed to certain tragedies. I think an author should have the right to do that. And so if you can download a book and like have it continue to circulate, it's sort of like, and I mean, I know you can't get all the physical copies, but as time goes on, it gets harder and harder. I don't know. This is a it's a complicated one.
Yeah, I do
Yeah,
not like the
it is.
notion of authors being able to unpublish a book and take it out of the. I don't like that at all. It enraged me when King did it, because
Really?
yeah,
I
I
mean,
get
he has
why.
the right,
I get
though.
his
He's an author.
reason.
He can decide.
Yeah, but okay, that's where you start to get into the question of like who really owns that book, because the author doesn't have an ownership stake of it once you've purchased it, right? He can't come into your home and take it. So,
No.
taking it off of your digital device to me is tantamount to stealing. And I feel like Amazon's done this, Apple's done this with digital content. It infuriates me when it's happened. But Apple, at least their policy is like you buy a movie or a TV show or something, they'll tell you in their hidden language that you need to download that somewhere so that it's yours, even if they lose the rights to it. But effectively, Amazon's saying you're not going to be able to do that anymore with the ebooks. So they
Yeah.
could take this away from you at any time.
Yeah, and like I kind of get it because it is really easy to remove DRM from the things that they have right now, so I get that they are protecting more from pirating. But I didn't even know this existed either, but I did go on it and went through my 80 pages of orders from Amazon and downloaded quite a few things just in case, 'cause I'm like I would be mad if I didn't have copies of these books anymore.
I don't keep mine. I mean, because you can only fit so much on the Kindle device, even the app on your phone. So like I usually, I make it a point to delete the titles off my phone when I'm done reading them, just to make sure I keep freeing up that space. But, you know, like it makes me question other stuff. You know, like we've got a home theater here. Like my wife's got a cabinet filled with DVDs that we never watch, but she owns them. You know, they're not going anywhere. I recently, there's a new Planet of the Apes movie that just came out on demand. And I went back and I wanted to watch like the other four or five that came out before it. And like everyone was like on a different platform. You know, like they were just all over the place. You know, like two of them I actually owned. I didn't even realize that I had bought them the first time around. You know, so like that, to me, that's the downside of buying some of this stuff. There's no physical, tangible thing. So like you don't really know what you bought, where you bought it from. You know, if it disappears and you've got a lot, you may not notice it. From a book standpoint, I do what Jenna does. If I stumble into a book that I like and I read it as an ebook or hear it as an audiobook, I'll usually buy the hardcover, you know, just to have it on the shelf, you know, somewhere in the house so I can revisit it at some point.
I do that too. But yeah, it's just another reminder that like on a platform that's digital, just like social media, that can all go away. And you don't really own any of
This is
that.
a really
So
strong argument, by the way, for authors to do direct sales, because you can control whether or not that reader gets to keep that book, you know. I don't know. I understand the reluctance to let go of the Kindle device. You know, I've got so many books on my Kindle. It's ridiculous, but I don't know, man. Things like this make me kind of I want something that's more under my control as a
yeah,
reader, you
I'm kind
know?
of with you. I know we talked about the indie bookstores now able to do ebooks, and I'm like, ah. And this one also makes me go, if they could get a competitive reader, I would look at it.
Pretty soon, Jenna's going to be the only one with a Kindle.
When the apocalypse happens and there's no electricity, your ebooks will be irrelevant anyway.
I, you know, I've heard that argument so many times. You know, a good
Meanwhile,
friend of
JD and
mine,
I not when
will
I build my Tesla coil and
have
pull electricity from the
our good
air.
friend of mine has like his entire, you know, like he's got a huge library of DVDs, laser discs, you know, all kinds of things, and he says the same thing. I'm like, you know, I'm thinking at that point, I got bigger problems than what am I going to read? Like, I think I'm probably
You've built
okay.
an effective fortress, Kevin. Come on. You live in Texas. Why are we having
All
this
right.
conversation?
Exactly. All right. Let's go to something a little less controversial. So senior Yorkie dog score, this is actually much more controversial in my opinion. We're going to get to that. But senior Yorkie dog scores dream New York publishing deal about his social media stardom. Kensington has released a series called The Dog Agency Novels, which feature stories inspired by canine social media stars, listing the dogs as co-authors. The series taps into the I'm having a hard time reading this. I'm sorry. The series taps into the popularity of pet influencers by creating stories around real-life dogs with large social media followings. For example, a dog called Ducky stars Ducky the Yorkie in a romance-inflected story. Despite the dog's online popularity and millions of followers, a recent book signing event saw no attendees, showing the unpredictable nature of translating social media fame into real-world interest. The novels are penned by experienced genre writers like Micah Stone and Amanda K. Morgan. Take that, struggling human writers. The secret is be a Yorkie.
You know, this actually reminded me of something I totally forgot about. But years and years ago, my wife had a blog, and it was kind of like a mommy blog that she did. Like, you know, put out two or three stories a week. But she ended up with like a, you know, pretty decent sized following. There's advertising and stuff going on. At one point, I started writing posts from our dog's point of view. There was a little dash hound named Toast, so they were basically called Toast posts. And we had so many people that loved those things. I did it as a one off, and then I kind of got stuck and had to come up with a new idea every week after week after week. But yeah, people love that, you know, for whatever reason.
Kara's thinking about doing something like that with our dog. Our dog's name is Minnie. She wants to do the Minnie series. She mostly wants to do it like an Instagram posts and things, you know, like Minnie at a coffee shop and, you know, whatever. I think it would be great. It irritates me a little though, because it's a little bit like remember when the show Castle was on the air and they started releasing books by Richard Castle, and that dude was consistently outselling me, like a fictional author. So this sort of thing kind of irks me a little, I'll be honest. Jealous of the dogs. Publishing has gone to the dogs.
Maybe Cutler needs a dog.
Cutler.
Just say, hey.
The Cotler Collie. We'll get
Yeah.
that going.
Just put me in the
Gotta be
acknowledgments
cute.
for this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm stealing
The
that.
thing that was super interesting to me is, 'cause I went on this dog's Instagram 'cause I had to stalk the dog after this, is they showed his bookstore signing and nobody came.
So
It
that's
was so
sad.
hard. But
That
I'm like,
breaks my
I don't even
heart.
know how that's possible. Like,
2 million
most
followers on social media and nobody came to the bookstore signing. And his little paw stamps and everything.
Oh my
Oh.
God. No.
Okay, yeah, that
But it
breaks
just
my
goes to
heart.
show you, social media doesn't sell books.
See, this is the thing. This is I
I
can't
know,
stand
no,
stories
no.
like that. Like, this is why I haven't watched John Wick, because a dog gets hurt. I can't stand even the emotional pain that the
It
dog
was
has. So,
sad, this poor dog, and
yeah,
nobody in the
no. All
bookstore.
right, we got
He
to
was
move
all
on.
dressed up and waiting with his books.
We have to move on.
I know.
We have to move on. Okay. Final story. This one also makes me mad. We'll find out why. James Bond producers give Amazon full creative control of 007. Amazon has acquired creative control of the James Bond franchise from Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson, the heirs of the original Bond film producer Albert Cubby Broccoli. This allows Amazon to potentially expand the Bond universe extensively through new films and spin-off TV shows on its Amazon Prime streaming service. With Amazon assuming creative control, the pathway is cleared for the production of new James Bond films and other related content, rejuvenating a franchise that has seen delays in recent years. This change could end the current hiatus, the longest in the franchise's history since the release of No Time to Die in 2021. This scares the crap out of me.
No, I mean, I think I'm where you are. You know, like to me, it feels like they're going to Star Wars this thing, right? Like, you know,
Worse, I think
Star
they're going to
Wars
Rings
was
of
good
Power
when,
it.
oh,
yeah, I mean,
don't.
it was cool when there was one movie coming out every couple of years, you know, like then you got excited about it. But like, you turn on the TV today, like Star Wars is literally everywhere. So we're going to see, they're going to milk this thing. You're going to see young Bond. You're going to see old Bond. You're going to see spin off of the side characters. You're going to have cartoons. You're going to have, oh, it just makes my head hurt. And like, it makes me sad. I've got so many friends that write in the Bond universe and they've kept that pretty tight. You know, you basically get the Bond Bible, you know, and you got to put all the pieces back in the box where you found them when you finish up the book. You know, like they're real strict about what you can and can't do. I feel like all of that stuff is going to go out the window.
Yeah, I will say this, those are totally separate franchises, the books versus the films. And the you know they've done a really good job, unless Amazon has struck another deal somewhere that we're not hearing about yet, which is entirely possible, being the publishing muscle they
Interesting,
are.
because as you talk about that, like Star Wars is actually wildly expansive in the book universe. I mean, there are hundreds of Star Wars books, but the movies, for better or for worse, and I don't want to get into that discussion, has focused on the Skywalker family specifically. And I know that they have recently branched out in different shows, which have been hit or miss, but the ones that have been a hit, I think have really been enjoyable. So I don't know. I like the idea of, getting to know Moneypenny a little bit more, or Q, or those are interesting characters that I don't know.
I'm right there with you. I'd love to see those stories. It's so sad that we're never going to see those stories. And then if we do, they're because they're coming in through Amazon, they will be completely ruined. Like they look at what they did with Rings of Power and the Lord of the
One
Rings franchise.
example. Can you can
Look at anything they've produced
people
over
can
the
make
past 10 years.
mistakes.
Yes.
They can
Yes, they can.
recover. They can overcome.
Yeah, I don't look for that to happen. I have no faith in this whatsoever. And I went and looked it up to see, like, you know, how long until these enter the public domain, and it's like 2063, and you know,
Yeah,
so
they're
there's
not
no,
that old.
yeah, it's not gonna happen. Because I was like, well, maybe we could just kind of take it over and do our own thing. But no, we're out of luck.
Well,
2035 is the earliest.
you can write a novel about Bames Jond
James
and
John. Seven double lot. Yeah,
this
that
is
won't get me.
this is exactly the kind of thinking they do not need at Amazon.
This is exactly right. That's what I was just thinking. Like, no, that's just me tearing the bricks out for them. That's all that's
Yeah.
happening there.
Well, I don't know.
All
Yeah,
right.
well.
What we need is Yorkie Bond, Yorkie 00 dog.
Islam, maybe we
Oh,
need a Baby Yoda
yes.
Bond crossover.
Yeah, Baby
That would
Yoda.
be, yeah, Baby
Grogu.
Bond. Baby
Baby
Bond.
Bond. Oh, okay. With that, JD, who is up this week?
This week we've got Adrian Tchaikovsky coming on. Adrian's a British science fiction and fantasy author who has won both the Arthur C. Clarke Award and the BSFA Award. His new novel is titled Days of Shattered Faith and releases March 4th. Adrian Tchaikovsky.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I'm really excited to talk to you today.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. So, we have a lot of writers and readers listening to our show, so we always kind of like to start at the beginning and hear your origin story, as it were. How did you get started writing?
I came to writing from tabletop role-playing games. I was a
Oh,
very keen player.
interesting.
But also a very keen games master, which involves a lot of world building skills and character creation skills and things like that. And very specifically, you're not just doing it in a vacuum because you are there as a group of people you are creating these story elements for. I then, at about the age of 16, 17, came across the Dragonlance Chronicles, the Weis and Hickman books, which were someone's Dungeons and Dragons campaign turned into novels. And that was just this light bulb moment of, oh, this is the thing I could potentially do. And that was when I decided, right, I'm going to write books. And it took me about 15 years to get to the point where I was writing good enough books to actually get them published. But that was definitely where it came from. And certainly a lot of the skills, the gaming skills that I had developed, translated pretty much unaltered into writing skills.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I've never actually like played Dungeons and Dragons, but I'm, a 90s kid, so all my friends were, like that's something I'm very familiar with. It kind of makes sense. You're telling a story. It's very interesting that you would then translate that into.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still a very world focused author, basically. My interest is very much in creating those sort of science fictional or fantastical places. And that is, that is really an identical skill for the two. But I think the thing about gaming being something that you are doing with other people and that you are creating stuff for other people to experience gives you that kind of sensibility towards how something is going to land with an audience, that is enormously useful as a writer.
That actually makes a ton of sense. I always sort of, when I'm talking to people who aren't, readers necessarily, and encouraging them to read more, I always describe reading as like a participation sport. Like the reader has to engage with the material. Like it's not just a passive thing. So that's fascinating that that's what gaming brought you. I think that's really interesting. So you started writing. You said it took about 15 years before you started writing books that were publishable. How did you go about getting published? Did you get an agent? All
Yeah,
that?
I mean, this is, I mean, I hit the shelves in 2007.
Okay.
And so I would have been, what, 2005, six, that I was going through my final round of submissions before I got an agent. At the time, you had the Writers and Artists Yearbook, which was a physical book that contained details of publishers and agent. There were about, I think, five publishers and three agents in that book that dealt with science fiction and fantasy. So I, and these were the, you know, I had been applying to basically these people for the last 15 years, one book a year.
Oh, wow.
But there wasn't really any other way of going about it. And this is also the time where, you weren't doing this by email. You were physically photocopying and printing out all of these copies and spending a fortune in postage. And most of the time, you never got anything back. And, or you might just get like a little slip saying, nah, not really interested. So it was, I think the situation now for writers is, there are, I wouldn't say easier, because I don't think it's ever easy in any way, and you just swap one problem for another, but there are a lot more
Right.
options. And also it's just easier to submit because you can, electronically is the standard way of it. But yes, there wasn't really the there was probably some level of self-publishing going on that I just wasn't aware of, but it certainly wasn't the second string of the industry as it is now.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Amazon, when did they kind of it's like the early teens, I think, is kind of when,
Feels like that, yeah.
yeah, somewhere in there. Yeah, I often wonder where all those manuscripts that everyone used to send in to publishing agencies ended up. Just are they in a warehouse somewhere waiting to be discovered still? I don't know. Maybe someone should write a book about
I
that.
just assume that sort of every what would have been Thanksgiving or Guy Fawkes Day, they all the publishers would just make an enormous bonfire of them and then dance around it, singing merrily, you know.
It's a very yes, I agree. So what is your writing process like? Do you tend to outline first and stick to that? Do you just sort of sit down and see where the words take you? How do you handle creating, especially because, as you said, you do create these
Yeah.
entire worlds that you're
I
building.
mean, a lot of it is kind of, I've grown a little more experimental as it's gone on. My standard procedure is really to plan quite heavily. And the one thing I do in every single case is I always know how the world works, how it fits together, who are the people, who are the factions, where are the places, what are the metaphysics, what are the technological advances, depending on the book. But I always have I need a very solid foundation under me. I need to feel that the world is real, because then hopefully my readers can feel that the world is real and it's bigger
Right.
than the one story of the book. And you get that sense of immersion that I think is science fiction and fantasy's strongest suit. Traditionally, I will also plan the plot chapter by chapter, beat by beat, in a very regimented way, and then I will write it in exactly that order. More recently, I'm experimenting a bit more with that. I'll always have the world, but for example, with the Tyrant Philosopher's books, the current fantasy series I'm working on, I'm taking create the world up to and including the characters I want to focus on, and then I will just basically follow them around in the situation I've created for them, and their own clashing goals and the pressures of the situation will develop the plot as I go. And I frequently don't know where it's going. But what I've found is things fall into place ahead of you. So every time you need to take a step forward, that step has come, and I'm currently about two-thirds-ish of the way through a book where I kind of knew that, right, there are a number of issues with this book that I'm going to have to solve at some point. And in each case, the characters have found those solutions without me having to really twist their arm about it. And
Oh,
so
that's
that's very pleasing. And I wasn't, when I first did that with City of Last Chances, I really wasn't sure it was going to work or whether the book would end up as 500,000 words or, all of these things. But as it is, I think I'm confident enough to go without a safety net in that way. And, but also, I've just been doing this long enough that a certain amount of the craft is just being carried on subconsciously so that I'm able to throw up those solutions without necessarily having to sit down and plan them out on paper.
yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, like after a certain amount of writing, it's sort of like you kind of instinctively can navigate, okay, this is where this needs to happen and that needs to
Well, I
happen.
think, yeah, and I think as you go on, you with confidence comes the willingness to take those risks, even small risks. So, yeah, my early fantasy work, it's all very much, it is epic fantasy. It's written in the past tense. It's written in third person. It's that standard voice that most epic fantasy is written in, and that works perfectly well. But as I've gone on, I've started to experiment a bit more with all of these elements and just work out, well, what can I get if I do this? What can I get if I do that? So for example, again with the Tyrant Philosophers, they are mosaic books. There are lots of characters and the action moves from character to character, from chapter to chapter. And then you have mosaic chapters which are kind of omniscient and just flit from head to head and give you this broader picture of what is going on in the world before focusing down onto one character's particular sort of struggles.
Yeah, I really enjoyed how that was structured and sort of flowed. And it did, I don't know that I would have necessarily like put a finger on it, but now that you have said that, and following the characters around, like there is sort of a feel like that as you're reading, you know, like, oh, what's gonna happen? And who is this? And oh, who is that? And it is sort of like a there's an energy, I suppose, behind the words, so that's really
Yeah,
cool.
and it's certainly something. I mean, I think the reason I decided I wanted to do it, there are a couple of big influences there. There's Angela Slatter wrote a series of short story collections where the short stories all kind of interrelate. I think it starts with Sourdough and then The Bitterwood Bible. I think they're the third one out recently. I haven't got to read yet, but they are very good. But also, they have this idea of you read a story and then you read a story about someone else and then someone and they read a story about someone else and then oh, the person in that story, that's the person from the first story. And you just get this all of these little stories that are actually still interconnected. But there's also there are there's a more there's a kind of a classic style of kind of 19th century literature. So Dickens does it a bit, and Victor Hugo certainly does it with things like Les Miserables, where the focus of the action is just kind of has the ADHD. And it's always just, oh, this is going on now, and this is going on, and now I will give you a 40-page digression about the sewer system of Paris and that kind of thing. And I actually rather like that. And I think it works very well. Yeah, but he is a good enough writer to make that happen. And I'm going to say I don't do 40-page digressions about architecture or anything like that because I am not that good. But it's still you get this sense of a world of lots of people, and yeah, these people are not they are not kings. They are not sort of great sort of statesmen or anything like that. They're all very sort of grassroots people at the bottom
Yeah,
of
very
society, but
normal.
and all of their lives interact in all of these weird and unexpected ways.
Yeah, it was really, yeah, it's a lot of fun to experience. Do you have to keep like a story Bible or some sort of document that sort of like has these details of the world, but also, as these characters are doing things that you're discovering, or is that all stuff that you can sort of keep track of in your head?
So these days, as I grow older and my memory ceases to become quite as good, it ceases to be quite as good as it was. These days, I will start off when I'm doing my world building, and I will write down a bunch of stuff, most especially things like what things are called. Because one of the things I'm doing in this series is just all right. You go to a place, people don't just call it. Oh, well, that is the city wall, and that is the temple. Everyone has names for things, and that's kind of just the way people work. So. In the current book, there is a group of magicians within the city. And of course, this group of magicians is not just called, yes, they are the magicians. They have a name for their group and they have a name for the head of their group and that kind of thing. And I've got to write those down to keep those straight. And then usually I will build my kind of the character list for the front of the book, which I've got to say, I know people don't like those necessarily. People can be a bit snobby about those. I find them very useful as a reader. I know a lot of my readers find them very useful. Just the idea, especially, if they're the book, there might have been a bit of a gap in the middle of the book, or maybe you can't remember, you read the previous book a while ago. So just having that reminder where you can go to at the front of the book, where you know where it is, and you're not going to see bits of the book you're not supposed to or anything like that. That's just a practical consideration, I think, that a writer should be given to a reader in this kind of book. But I'm usually building that as I go along. So every time, if I have a new character turn up, I say, right, I will put them in the dramatis persona at the beginning, just so that's where they are. And then if I forget how to spell their name, that's where I can go to check. Yeah, which absolutely happens. And I still, that doesn't mean I always get it right when I'm writing. And hopefully the editors will then pick up on any variants I've got when they come around to it.
Did you find that it's easier or more challenging to sort of write an interconnected series versus one that is sort of, a linear, I don't want to say linear, but a series that builds like, the sequel after the sequel after the sequel?
I find it more entertaining to write these interconnected the more mosaic type stories. And in this, each book in this series to date is intended that you can pick it up without having read the previous ones. There are continuing threads and characters which you can get sort of added value from when you recognize them, but each book should stand on its own. Which means it's kind of, you don't have that burden of trying to get the scaffolding for a whole series done whilst also, because one of the things I believe very strongly in if you are writing a series of books, is that each book also needs to stand on its own. This is something I was doing right from the beginning with Shadows of the Apt. Shadows of the Apt, it's a 10-book series. And there is an overplot that works in various segments over those 10 volumes. I'm waving my hand wildly just for people who obviously cannot see me doing this. But at the same time, each book has its own particular thing, its own particular kind of problem that the characters need to solve. It has a resolution. You get to the end of the book, you get a payoff. It's not just sort of, that's the end of that piece of sausage and the next one will pick up exactly right where that left off. Because I, as a reader, I find that very unsatisfying.
Yeah.
So I think if you get to the end of suddenly, you know, a decent length of fantasy book, you've read 300,000 words. You want you to feel like something has been achieved at the end of it. It's not just like, and then dot, dot, dot.
Right. Yeah. Which, you know, can sometimes be good because then you just have fans rabidly waiting and harassing you mercilessly to finish the next book. But then also.
Yes. Also, that is also bad.
Right. Yeah. That's really interesting because you do see that a lot in other genres, you know, like mystery in particular. You know, it's like you've got the super.
Yes. There's a lot of series where there is a continuity of character. So you're investigator type character, but the stories have very little sort of you can kind of read them out of sequence. And that in sci-fi and fantasy, it is traditional that if there is a set of books, there is an order in which to read it. There are very few where that's not the case. I think Ian Banks' The Culture novels are a really interesting exception where any of those books can be picked up. And very few of them particularly are, you know, I think there's like a couple that exist in a temporal sequence.
Yeah.
And the rest are all just, yeah, this is happening over the period of like X hundred years. And the continuity is the culture.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Did you know, going back to sort of being a game master and you know, a game is inclusive, and I'm assuming that you might still build on it. Do you think that's where that came from, or where did that come from, that instinct in you to sort of follow that in sci-fi and fantasy?
I'm not quite sure what you're asking. Follow what?
The not doing, you know, book one, it has to go into book two.
Oh, well, I mean, I don't think it's an instinct because certainly all my other stuff is very linear. You know, you've got to read the Shadows of the Apt books in order. You've got to read the Final Architecture in order. Even series like the Children of Time series or the Dogs of War books, where the books are still individual books, you know, because those were not planned as series. So they're just really a sequence of books in the world, but each book builds on the previous one sufficiently that you kind of still have to read them in order. This is the first time I've really done something.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Where you can just pick up, you know, so you can pick up Days of Shattered Faith, which is the one that was out end of last year in the UK. And that should read on its own perfectly fine. But if you had read the previous book, you'd say, oh, that's that guy. And
right,
that, you know, that's that group of people. And also the way it's going to work is there is a story being told in the background about the Palacene, who are the tyrant philosopher. They're the kind of the oppressive sort of colonialist imperial force stomping about making everyone's lives a misery. But the point of the series is that the book is never about that. The book is about the small people who are affected by it. So you see this, what would under other circumstances be the traditional big fantasy plot going on absolutely in the background, but it's kind of like you're seeing human things from the position of insect. So everyone else is just very small and usually doesn't particularly have a dog in that race, save that they just want to be able to eat. And want be able to, you know, want not to be shot by the sort of when the revolution gets put down and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they all get caught up in it, obviously, but their motive isn't to be the revolutionary hero or anything like that.
Yeah. And I like that. There is something like very real about that, I suppose, you know, epic fantasy where you've got a sweeping hero is, you know, they're fun and they're great and I love reading them, but it is also very satisfying to, you know, as you're reading it, and it is about how are these one group of people and these different people in this city reacting to a situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think traditionally fantasy has a bit of a class problem. And a bit of a kind of a privilege problem in that And this is something that the genre has absolutely inherited wholesale from all the way back into like the Middle Ages romances, where you get, you know, here is a group of people who will do things, and they are all princes and kings and royalty and
Right.
so forth. And that you get something, you know, so that there is this set of characters in traditional fantasy who are allowed to be heroes. And frequently it is, well, you are of this bloodline, or there is a prophecy,
Right.
or you know, there's some particular exclusive reason. It's very much this almost like a great man of history sort of school of literature. And I'm trying to get away from that, like a lot of writers are these days. And the idea of actually maybe it's just where you happen to end up that means you've got your fingers on the scales in order to change these world events.
Yeah,
And
no, I
maybe that's
really
not
like
actually,
that.
you're not the questing hero prophecy to do this thing. It's just like you're the person there who can kick the enemy general in the shins and then run away or something like that.
Yeah, you don't have to be the chosen one to make a difference. You can
You
just
can
do.
choose yourself.
You can choose yourself. I love that. So, as I was reading your bio, some things stuck out. Zoology, psychology, law, your Dungeons and Dragons, the Game Master. It's quite an eclectic resume. It makes a lot of sense, and I imagine each one brings very individual strengths to your ability to write and create worlds. Did you see, or, as you were starting to write and find your way in the world, that your interests sort of aligned with wanting to be a writer, or did you just sort of have the two separate for a while? I
I
don't know
mean,
if.
I don't think it's possible. If you have interests, I don't think it's possible for them not to align with being a writer, because you're naturally going to be drawn to writing about the things that interest you. So, I mean, I've read a lot of epic fantasy, and role-playing games tend to be epic fantasy. So I wrote my earliest books are epic fantasy, but at the same time, they're also about people with like insect powers, because I've always been fascinated with insects and spiders and things like that. So it's taking a particular mode of literature, particular genre and its tropes, and then saying, right, now I will inject the my own personal spin on this and make it hopefully something that's ticking all of the right boxes, but is still doing something interesting and different within that space. And I
Yeah.
think, if you have interests, everyone has something to bring to writing in that way.
Yeah, I definitely the insects. Usually you don't see insects outside of like horror in a way.
Well, this is the other thing. I mean, I've dedicated a lot of my writing career to improving the general PR of insects and spiders and things.
I'm sure they appreciate it immensely. I think you touched on this a little bit, just on basically sort of taking away the class problem from fantasy, but more specifically, if there was something that, you were able to sort of imbue on your readers that you hoped that they would take away from your books, what would it be, if anything?
I mean, the big things that come out, rather other than maybe don't hit that spider with a shoe. The big thing that a lot of my books circle around is a matter of empathy, really. It's a matter of being able to see across a divide that the person, or indeed spider that you are dealing with, is also a person. And I kind of figured if I could write a book where I'd get people to root for the spiders, then that was the challenge really with Children of Time, and that seems to have worked. But because there's nothing people hate more than spiders, basically. But it does seem to be the thing I keep coming back to, and it does seem to be, I think, the thing. If I could kind of just reach into everyone's brain and make everyone see this particular thing, just the idea of like having that empathy for other people, or other anythings, other living things, is why we exist as a species. Yeah, we are a social species. We are wired to work together in commonality. We're not supposed to be this, this person is incredibly rich and powerful, therefore they can do what they want. That's not, I feel, the natural state of humanity. It's something that's been hijacked. And so the more I can write books about the small people getting their moment of heroism and about people seeing across that divide, the better. Sorry, that was a bit heavy.
I love that though. I really do think that that's what books can bring to us in so many different ways. Yeah, and so don't kill the spider. I don't mind spiders. Scorpions are a bit creepy. They creep me out, but that's okay.
I kind of love. We don't really. There are. I think there may be a couple of species with a very limited range in the UK. So it's not something we tend to get around here. But yeah, I mean the UK. I mean, ironically, for a country where everyone seems to be absolutely terrified of spiders, we don't really have any dangerous species whatsoever. And in fact, just a fairly limited sort of arthropod fauna in overall.
I live in the desert, so there's a lot of things that are trying to kill me here. It's all right though. fine. What has been the biggest surprise over the course of your career?
I mean that anyone wants to read anything I've written, to be honest. I mean, Children of Time was a surprise to everyone. Children of Time was not intended to be a big success. It was didn't have a marketing budget. It had came with a tiny advance. It was very much, all right, you're doing just about okay as a fantasy writer. Get this, spiders from outer space thing out of your system, then back to the swords and the dragons. And then it just kind of exploded. And it turned out to be the book that a lot of people had kind of been very ready for. And I still can't particularly account for it. I'm not in obviously in any way complaining, but the fact of that, and then suddenly pivoting to mostly writing science fiction and having to wrestle a bit to get back to fantasy, which I still really enjoy writing.
Yeah, but it is sort of interesting, but I guess, it's like that thing, the unexpected ends up sort of being not the expected, but the thing that everyone needed in the end.
Yeah, and I mean the thing is, at the end of the day, if it was the case that it was possible to predict which book was going to be the big book, then only one book would get published. So, it's good that these things are rather looser than all that.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, we like to end with this same question for everyone, which is, what is one piece of advice you would give to new or aspiring writers?
Ooh, I mean, this is really tough because, I know a lot of writers. By the way, do please do see, there's them doing work next door, so you may be able to hear drilling. I know a lot of writers, and everyone has got to where they are by very different methods. So it's very hard to say anything that's of general use.
Yes.
So for, for me, it's obvious, you plan the world out as thoroughly as you possibly can. And that's what your writing is built on. But I also know people who do phenomenal work just sitting down and writing, and it all just comes out. So gaming metaphor, I guess. Getting anywhere in certainly traditional publishing, which is the only form I particularly know about, is really that it's rolling that natural 20 on a dice. There is, however good you are, there is a colossal amount of luck involved. You cannot control most of these things. You need your manuscript to land in front of the right editor at the right time when the market is looking for a particular type of book, and the editor has had a good lunch and is feeling very well disposed towards the world, and all of these things to line up. And at that point, you maybe have a chance that they will get through the full set of sample chapters you sent in or whatever, and call you up and say, "Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing the rest of this book." But the thing you can control is what you're sending them. I sent out a lot of very half-baked stuff, convinced it was gold dust. The
Yes.
more you can just, give it that extra read through, give it that extra edit. If you're in a position, if you are someone who is able to take criticism, maybe make put, get into a writer's group, find people who are not your immediate family to critique it for you, anything like that. And I'm saying that with that proviso because Lord knows I would not have accepted criticism at the time. I was phenomenally pigheaded. It probably set me back quite a few years. If you're someone who can go to conventions and talk to people without getting really desperate about wanting to be in print, again, a thing I would not have been able to do at the time, that's probably a good idea. I've certainly seen that work for people. But Really, you want, if you're rolling that dice, you want to give yourself the biggest modifier on that dice roll that you can, and that is the thing you can control, which is making sure what you send in is as good as possible.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. Well, thank you so much for your time today. This has been an absolute delight. I have loved the Philosopher Tyrant series. I look forward to the next.
Excellent. Well, I'm writing it at the moment. There we go.
Excellent, excellent. All right. Well, thank you again.
No, thank you.
Well, I always think it's really interesting listening to how writers, sort of like got their start. What was their approach? And it was really interesting that he got it through, RPGs, Dungeons and
Yeah.
Dragons. And not just that, because he was like, well, I like fantasy, but specifically on how to approach a story with the reader in mind, which I know we've talked about it before, and I know a lot of re writers will say, don't worry, write for you, and then, the reader later. So it's tricky. How and when do you handle reader expectations when you're writing?
I do not.
Yeah, me
I don't know
neither.
about the rest of. I mean, for me, like I literally pretend I'm telling the story to one person. And
Yeah.
most of the time, it's my wife at this point. But like that's how I dial it in and try to get it to the point where I feel like it's a tight story. And like I'm in there in the moment as I'm telling it. I don't really think about the reader. I don't think about who's going to get offended, who's going to like this, who's not going to like this. I feel like if you let any of those kind of thoughts creep into your head, it's going to start shaping the story in a way that may not be organic and may not be the way you want to go. It's better to just tell the story.
That's the time-honored advice, right? You have an ideal reader. That's who you're writing for. It doesn't matter who else reads it. For a lot of us, that's us. I mean, that's me. I don't. My wife won't read my stuff anymore. I mean, she because she's like, I want to read other books. You put out too many.
Man, that damn
So
restraining order.
that's exactly. Yeah, I'm hoping to get that lifted.
I guess though, like JD, I mean, you are sort of writing for an ideal reader if you're imagining that you're writing for your wife. Like, so you are sort of shaping with that reader experience in mind, in a way, I'd argue.
I think so, but I have to focus like on one person because I read all of my reviews, so I see the good, the bad, the ugly. I see what people don't like. I see people telling me that I should have trigger warnings. I've got other people telling me I shouldn't, and like all of that noise, like I don't want that in my head.
Yeah.
I would
Yeah.
rather just sit down and tell the story to the one person. I know I'm not going to make everybody happy. I would rather just make one person happy.
Yeah.
How do you keep them out of your head? I know this is going to be a grilling JD session, but most authors don't read their reviews. So it is interesting that you read them and then somehow manage to put it all in a box and put it on the shelf.
I honestly think, because I've had a lot of talks with people about this, I think it's the autistic side of me. Like I can look at them objectively. Like I don't get upset. Like I can read a one-star review where they tear the book apart, and like my mind is at, well, that's a valid point. Maybe that's not. This is, and then I put it aside. But like I've got other author friends that would read that same review and then go find the nearest bridge and stand on the edge of it for like the next 2 hours, and like that's just not me.
Yeah,
Interesting.
I can read. I don't like seeing negative reviews, but I, and I don't get very many.
Of course not. Of course
Once in
not.
a blue moon.
Yeah.
Message to listeners, get on that. Kevin Tomlinson over on Amazon.
Actually, the only time I seem to get negative reviews is when they have an agenda. Like they didn't like something I wrote that has some political flavor or whatever, and they've decided they want to tank the book because they don't like my perspective or whatever.
That is a review thing that happens.
But then for the most part, like I don't pay attention to what they're telling me to do if there's a negative or positive review. Because hey, go write your own book. I mean,
Right.
I'm the
Well, I
one who
think
put
sometimes
myself on the line to do it.
there's valid thoughts out there, and like, and if you hear the same thought over and over again, I think you got to give it a little bit
Yeah.
of credence. I mean, the ones
I
that
agree.
bother me, like my next book coming out, it's something I keep upstairs. It's about a haunted house, obviously paranormal. You can tell right from the description. There's reviews on NetGalley from people that like they will start off their review, I don't normally read paranormal. You
Yeah.
know, and like to me, like that's not even the person I want to hear from. Like I don't eat Chinese food, so I'm not gonna, get out there and start reviewing Chinese restaurants or telling you whether Chinese food is good or bad because I don't know. I don't like it.
Yeah.
Like So those types of reviews, I think you got a discount. But you know,
Yeah.
if people are pointing out characterization, you know, if they're saying your dialogue needs help or this is going on or that's going on, and you're hearing from multiple people, I think it's worth looking at.
It just stings for a minute. But though
Yeah.
one of the I read a lot of reviews for the last book, and some of them just they make me laugh because it's like you didn't do your research because you called the prison guards guards instead of officers. And I'm like, well, actually in the state in prison I'm in, they call them guards. So I don't know where you're from. Maybe they call them officers there, but I did research it. So just those ones, they make me laugh. I did put a safety on my Glock, so I didn't get that review.
And that's the
You know,
classic one.
no safeties on the Glock, no safeties
I had someone
on
in early
the
days, you know, because I started off writing science fiction, and my first science fiction novel included a spaceship crashing into the atmosphere of of this planet, and I said I'm gonna futz the wording here, but I mean I said something about her, the pilot, adjusting the attitude of the craft. And I had a reviewer just ream me over that, like a five paragraph dissertation basically about how, you know, how can you call yourself a professional if you confuse the word, you know, when you meant to say altitude and you said attitude and you said it like five times. And someone else kindly posted like the Wikipedia
it actually is called
entry
attitude.
about, yeah, because I was
Yeah.
using an aviation term. So I'm like, man, if I would give anything to have a webcam on that guy's face
Yeah.
when he's that bad.
Here's a thought about trigger warnings, though, because JD was mentioning them. And I had this idea, and you can tell me whether it's a good or bad idea. I think you should put a website link for trigger warnings for people who want them or don't, because then you can get them on your mailing list.
Ooh.
That's it. My
Clever.
only thought.
Okay, I'm on board with that. Yeah.
I do think that trigger warnings are good to have. I don't know about putting them in like up front. I know some authors will say there are trigger warnings. You can find them on my website. So the people who want to know what they are can go see them. I have seen that come up more and more. And then the people who don't. Yeah, because sometimes they can maybe spoil a book a little bit, but I don't know. It's
Here's
kind
my
of
trigger warning. This is what I'm going to tell people. Always pull the trigger toward you. If you push it away from
wow.
you, that's bad.
That's a good
Oh,
warning.
Kevin. But even with trigger warnings, like I know you and I both read Butcher and Blackbird, which was pitched as a
Yes.
rom-com serial killer.
Right.
And the trigger warnings were
Or
written in a
hilarious.
way that was so hilarious
Right.
that I didn't really believe them until I
Yeah.
got there and I was like, oh my God, what am I
That's the
reading?
that
So
is literally the only way I think you should put a trigger
yeah.
warning in anything.
They were
I mean
funny.
it, to make fun
Well,
of
that
it.
was the whole tone of the book, though. So, I
Yeah.
mean, you couldn't pull that off. Like, I don't think JD could get away with hilarious trigger warnings at the beginning of
Probably not.
that book, for
I
example.
could see a trigger warning for something I keep upstairs is just like warning about, you know, what you should and should not do with certain objects or whatever, you know. Please
Yeah, I mean,
don't.
I could come up with something to have fun with it, but you know, like
Yeah.
for me, like I don't know if it's because I'm getting older or what, but like I don't necessarily want to go out and have to figure out what offends people in today's world
Yeah,
and
no,
have to do that
I'm.
again for the next book and the next book.
Well, I think that trigger warnings have gotten a little wild out there, as things do. You know, they evolve. But I think for the most part, like it's probably pretty easy. You know, if you just think about what we're writing towards, what might scar someone.
What kind of idiot picks up a book that is clearly horror or, you know, it's clearly going to have violent themes or whatever, and needs to be warned that those themes are in the book?
The specific types
No,
of violence,
yeah.
though. So I am okay with a
Nah.
lot of horror, but I
Yeah.
won't read certain things. I won't. I
Right.
can't. It's
Okay.
just, it's not that, you know, I'm gonna like devolve into a puddle of goo on the floor and need, you know, months of
Yeah.
therapy, but it's just not something I enjoy reading about.
Yeah.
And
Okay. All right.
so,
I get
you
it.
know, like I know a lot of people who love horror and they won't read books where the dog dies.
Yeah.
And they, if
Okay. There
there's,
you go. I'm one of those people. Yeah. All
right.
right.
So that is, you know, it's too much for some people. Like it just, you know, there's,
Yeah.
I know mothers who can't read about kids dying, especially if they, you
Yeah.
know,
Yeah.
have experienced children dying
Oh,
or
all right. You've turned me around on
See,
this.
Janice
Yeah.
has said what
So,
I said. I was like,
congratulations.
I think those big ones, like violence
Yeah.
towards children, violence towards animals, graphic violence or rape towards women. I do think
Yeah.
those are valid trigger warnings. Like some
Someone
people
I'm still
surviving
not going to do
domestic
it, but you've turned
violence
my opinion around.
may
Thank
not
you.
want to read about domestic violence. So,
Yeah.
all right, we did it, Christine.
Yay.
All right, well, I'm going to
Points.
shift a little bit.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking
Thanks
about
for that warning.
fears a little bit. And I think, it's kind of funny because we have talked about that. We all, I think, tend towards the darker side of fiction where we exaggerate our fears in our writing. And I thought it was so interesting that he sort of took the opposite approach and took something that he thinks most people are afraid of and tried to create empathy for the spiders. And has successfully done it. Have you ever even thought about doing that? And if you did, what would it be? Why would you why would you choose that? Like it's a very interesting idea.
Yeah, I was thinking about it the other way. Now, see, I don't know. I was like, what if I did a horror book with unicorns? They could like gore you and it would be awful.
I can totally see that on film. Somebody's walking up to the cute unicorn, and all of a sudden, it gets them with that horn.
Okay, that's the opposite of
Yeah,
I'm
that's
sorry,
not what we're
empathy. You're
talking about.
talking
No,
empathy.
the only time I've done this is in The Fourth Monkey. Like my serial killer, I've got diary entries from him when he's a kid. And at the end, like when you read that last diary entry, I can guarantee you're gonna feel bad for him.
Yeah.
And you know
Yeah.
that was my goal because I didn't want him to be, black or white. I wanted to paint him in a, kind of a gray, just so the readers walk away, with that last thought.
Yeah, it's just it's, I think, really interesting. I think people tend to, we lean into our fears and we explore them and pull them apart. And I thought, what an interesting exercise to take something that people would be afraid of and try to examine the other side of that.
I just watched a video, and it was kind of an experiment because they were testing to see if because we've always been told like humans are born with certain fears sort of built in. You got a fear of falling, fear of darkness, and one of those was always snakes. And what they did was they took a room full of babies and toddlers, and then they put snakes loose in there, and the parents are on the other side of a glass, just don't touch it, don't touch it, freaking out. And the babies are like picking it up, hugging it. One of them put the tail in its mouth,
Oh my
so they discovered like the babies have zero fear of these snakes. It's a learned fear. So
Yeah.
this
Well,
sounds like one of those things Doge is going to uncover and say they just spent
yeah.
$53 million on this
Right.
particular experiment.
I remember when Kyle was a baby. I don't know where I heard it from, but it was if a baby fall or if a child falls and the mother doesn't react, does it even really hurt? Because there are you can watch. One of the hardest things for me as a very adventurous child was to not react. Like I had to learn how to not go. Because every time I did that, immediate tears. But if I just sort of like kept it in and was like, "How you doing, kiddo?" Most times he would get up, brush himself off, and just go run off. No tears, no nothing. And it's interesting to think about that, what we ingrain
Yeah.
sometimes subconsciously in our kids.
Yeah, I had that was somewhere I had done that too. Like if you don't react, they will be fine. So I just he used to fall and I just be like, "You're fine." So then I remember one time we were on a bike ride and he didn't see there's like one of those poles in between a bridge and he just plowed into it. He was like way older and just like it was bad. I was like, "That must have hurt." And he's just like, "I'm fine." He got up and on his bike and I'm like, "I might have gone too much one way with that. I don't know."
Yeah, I think the
Bone
key
sticking
is
out.
to not react when that's what,
Just a
to
scratch.
ask like, "How you doing? You all right?"
You're
Like you didn't
right.
say,
Yeah. I
yeah,
think you're gonna have a
like,
bruise.
yeah, just sort of pause and give them like a little bit, but
Yeah.
anyway, it's
Well, we don't have kids, but my wife does that to me all the time. When I
she tells
fall
you you're
down.
fine. You're
How
fine.
you doing? You okay?
Yeah, well, see,
I'm
look at
fine.
that. She's emotionally validating you, Kevin. That's very nice of
I
her.
feel validated. Yeah.
Oh. All right. JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Steve Barry coming on. Steve's a New York Times and number one international best-selling author of 17 Cotton Marlowe adventures, five standalone thrillers, and several works of short fiction. His books have been translated into 41 languages with over 25 million copies available in 52 countries. Somewhere in the world, every 30 seconds, a Steve Barry book is sold. His latest is called The Medici Return and just released on February 11th.
Fantastic. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.